Today's episode comes with a content warning. We will be discussing sexual racism and racial fetishization, and derogatory language will be examined. So asking someone out on a date really sucks, right? It's vulnerable and it's risky, and this is especially true for men who have sex with men. What if the person they approach is homophobic? They might be opening themselves up to verbal or physical abuse. So on the surface, dating apps seem like a pretty great technological innovation that makes dating suck a bit less, especially for men who have sex with men. But the truth is that all too often, the apps themselves enable and sometimes profit off of discriminatory attitudes and behaviors of their users. Hey everyone, and welcome to Gender, Sex, and Tech, continuing the conversation. I'm your host, Jennifer Jill Fellows, and today I'm joined by Dr. Christopher Dietzel. Christopher Dietzel is a postdoctoral fellow at the Sexual Health and Gender Lab at Dalhousie University. He researches sexual consent related to dating app use and sexual violence against LGBTQ+ people. Chris has worked as a research assistant on the Impacts Project, a 7-year Social Science and Humanities Research Council partnership grant that aims to address sexual violence on university campuses across Canada and internationally. And he has worked on an Australian Research Council linkage project titled Safety, Risk, and Well-being on Digital Dating Apps. His research explores the intersections of identity, safety, and technology, with a particular focus on the experiences of people of diverse gender and sexual identities. And today, he's here to talk to me about racism and the online dating app world. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Jill. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yay! So as we sit here chatting in digital space, because we're not in the same space together.
Nope.
I want to take a moment and really try and ground that digital space in physical space. I think it's really important to resist a dichotomy between digital and physical space, because digital space occupies and relies on the existence of physical space. So as I record Gender, Sex, and Tech, continuing the conversation today, I'm mindful that I am a settler occupying physical space on the unceded land of the Coast Salish people of the Keekyte Nation. And Chris, where are you joining us from today?
Yeah, so I'm joining from Halifax, Nova Scotia, which is located in Mi'kma'ki, the ancestral and unceded territory of the Quebec peoples.
So to begin, could you tell us a little bit about your academic journey? Like, how did you start out in university? Maybe what led you to becoming interested in researching sexual health, and particularly this digital context?
Yeah, so I always really enjoy talking about my journey into this particular field because, and I'll explain this more in a minute, it kind of started with unsolicited dick pics.
Okay.
Yeah, which, you know, in terms of launching a career in academia isn't necessarily what one might expect, but it's certainly how I've come to study this particular topic. So yeah, in terms of that little spoiler alert, I'll give you a bit more background to explain how I got here. So my background is in education. I've worked at universities and schools, done like facilitating workshops, community work. I've done this for years and years and years. I've always wanted to work with students, and I really enjoy facilitating the learning process for people of any and all ages. So after I graduated from my university, I worked abroad. So I did my studies in the States, and then I lived in France and Singapore, where I was working on different university programs and teaching. And then after those ended, I moved to Montreal to do a master's at McGill. And during that time, I started working on this research project, the Impacts Project, which you referenced before. And so that project is specifically focused on sexual violence and rape culture. And so while I was a master's student, you know, I was talking with other students, we're having conversations about our work, trying to make sense of what we're doing. And it was quite funny because there was one afternoon when I was talking with a couple of the other research assistants, and one of them, she started talking about how she was really excited about going on a date later that afternoon, except that this afternoon, I guess her date must have been in the evening, because this afternoon when we were all chatting, she was like really frustrated because the guy had just sent her an unsolicited dick pic.
Oh.
And yeah, I know. So she was like, we had great conversation. Things were going really well. I thought he had similar values. And then right before meeting up this evening, you know, he sends me this photo.
Kind of dampens the excitement for the date.
Oh, very much so, right? Yeah. She and me and another person, all three of us were research assistants at the time. And so she was just kind of complaining and sharing her frustration, rightfully so. But particularly with the three of us having this shared experience on the Impacts Project, looking at sexual violence, it really got me thinking about how something that could be very easily brushed off as, you know, just kind of a typical normal experience for a woman to have happen as she's going through online dating is actually much more than that. You know, this really brings up a lot of conversations about power, about sexuality, about feminism, misogyny, thinking about violence in everyday situations, and certainly issues of consent. And so that really just got me thinking about my own experiences as a gay man and how women's experiences with unsolicited dick pics are very different from what I've experienced and have had friends experience in the world of queer people. And so this little bug started, itching in my brain, and I got really curious about if or how other people had looked at queer people's experiences with consent and violence, particularly in the realm of dating apps. And lo and behold, not much work had been done. So yeah, it really just got me very curious about how something like an unsolicited dick pic or other experiences of consent and sexual violence permeate these everyday interactions that can become so banal, whether that's on a dating app or using social media, whatever the case may be. It really got me curious about how we think about gender and sexuality, as well as safety and health, consent in these digital spaces, and what impact that has on both our online and offline interactions.
I feel like you've already raised this a little bit, but it sounds like your work is informed by the feminist theory of intersectionality in terms of thinking about, for example, you've already talked about the experiences of straight women with regards to these dating apps, as opposed to the experiences that happen in queer communities, for example.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about how intersectionality informs your work?
For sure. So, and again, this is so interesting because even before I got to university, like even before I did my master's or my PhD, I kind of realized that I had an interest in intersectionality without having the words to describe it as a concept.
Mm-hmm.
And so intersectionality is this idea that was developed by Kimberly Crenshaw, and it's a concept that is meant to capture this notion that people have multiple identities and that society has systems and institutions that grant privilege and power based on people's identities. And so the theory of intersectionality comes in to recognize how the multiple forms of identity can relate to inequality, disadvantage, oppression, and certainly when these identities intersect, intersectionality, this can compound and create obstacles mm-hmm. for people who find themselves at the margin of multiple marginalized identities. So I know that was kind of like a long answer to the question of like, what is intersectionality? But in terms of how it informs my work, I find intersectionality very important because all of us have multiple identities, and whether or not we think about our identities, particularly in relation to normative or dominant identities, all of us have multiple identities. And so with intersectionality, I really like to think about how those identities come into impacting our experiences. So whether that's with other people, whether that's with systems, institutions, society, community, whatever, by thinking about how our identities influence our experiences, and certainly then how it also influences our safety and health and well-being.
And these power relations too that you were talking about.
Yeah, very much so. Exactly.
Who gains the privilege of kind of having perceived power, or having power granted to them in these systems, versus who does not necessarily gain those privileges?
100%. And that's part of the reason why I, now looking back on previous, like my experiences prior to being in academia, is like I've realized that intersectionality is a lens that I've applied to my work, you know, in my day-to-day life, just trying to understand how I and other people go through the world, you know, and some of us certainly have more power and privilege. Some of us face oppression and barriers, but I really like thinking about intersectionality because it helps us scrutinize the issues and problems and encourages us to think about how identity influences outcomes. or how, you know, society's response to identity influences outcomes.
And I think it's also really interesting that you talked about grappling with or using this concept, this lens, before you had the words for it, and then kind of gaining the words and gaining kind of more knowledge about how other people have used this theory. I can only imagine was kind of like a more clarifying moment even.
Yeah, and that's something that I've really enjoyed by being in academia is there's so many concepts and so many ideas that I have yet to discover, you know, somebody else might be on their way to discovering. And I really appreciate that it's helping us make sense of the world that we live in. Sometimes, of course, it makes it easier or sometimes more challenging to address these concepts, you know, the actual problems. But nonetheless, it gives us the language to understand what's happening. So yeah, I've really enjoyed, and intersectionality truly has become integral to so much of the work that I do.
So we've talked kind of about your general research and how you came to do research in sexual health. Can we speak a little bit about the specific research project you conducted that led to the chapter in the book Gender, Sex, and Tech?
Sure. So the study that I conducted for my chapter in Gender, Sex, and Tech, this came out of a larger research project in which I examined how men who have sex with men interact on dating apps and through dating apps. So not just their online interactions, but also if they connect with somebody online and meet in person. So in this larger project, I really wanted to explore how men who have sex with men, or MSM, how MSM understand and practice consent in their online and offline interactions, and then how they experience sexual violence through their use of apps. So my project wasn't conceptualized to specifically look at race. However, as I was conducting the interviews and as I was going through to look at consent and look at sexual violence, I realized that many of the participants' experiences varied because of their identity. And race was such a prevalent and obvious way in which that it varied. And so, you know, just as I was doing my analysis, I found that it was impossible to ignore the ways in which that racism is embedded in society, especially when applying this intersectional framework of analysis. So truly, like, that was the inspiration of my chapter. Is I just was going through and was like, wow, there's so much here that I didn't expect to find, but of course makes sense that's there. And so rather than, I mean, I've inserted bits and pieces, of course, in my other chapters or other works that I've done, but it felt really good to be able to focus explicitly on this in this book chapter. So thank you for that opportunity.
Absolutely. I also think it's really, really cool the idea that you start a research project perhaps intending to examine one question, and through the gathering of the qualitative data and analysis, you find out, hey, there's all these other questions here that perhaps were not on your radar. And I've totally had that moment where I'm like, of course, like, why wasn't this on my radar?
Yeah. There's a few instances that immediately come to mind when you're saying that. And it's one thing that I love about research is that, and I tell this to my students too, is sometimes the point of research is actually to come out with more questions than answers.
So
this is where, even in conducting the interviews and gathering the data for this project, you know, I'm a white cisgendered gay male, and there was one of my participants who is Black. He was sharing his experiences with me in our interview, and a few times he paused because what he was going to say was going to be directed at me as a white man.
Right.
And so I think this was even a quote that I put in my chapter, is how he talked about white guys with blonde hair and blue eyes. And that's describes me. So, you know, it wasn't captured in the quotes, but we had a good conversation about it, honestly, of just like, and this is where, again, intersectionality comes into our day-to-day lives. It's this idea of not just our fixed identities, but our positionality with other people in terms of how we walk into a room and how our identity interacts with everybody else in that room.
So then when you're in these interview spaces, it's not like you've stepped outside of the structural power dynamics that exist.
No, not at all. And I think that's something, I mean, I'm a qualitative researcher by nature, and I just, this idea of objectivity, I think is very, I mean, can we actually ever be objective? You know, like, as a researcher, sure, I might be asking the questions, but I'm the one who came up with them. I'm the one who analyzes them. So
yeah.
I feel very fortunate that I was able to have these conversations very openly with participants who have different identities than me. And I'm really excited to share this work because I think that other people can continue to build on this and probably find things that I didn't just because of my own positionality. So
right.
I really encourage people to critique this work, to build on this work, to do more, and that's what I want to do as well, is continue to explore some of these issues that I uncovered, because I think so much more work needs to be done in this area.
So let's back up for any listeners who don't know. What are dating apps?
Yeah.
How do they work? What's the history of them? So here we are talking about research you did on MSM using dating apps and the kind of encounters or relationships both online and in person that came out of the use of these dating apps. But for anybody who hasn't used one, what are they? What's the history of them?
Yeah, it's such a good question. And actually, when I was preparing for this, you know, for our little podcast talk, I quite enjoyed the fact that you asked me this question explicitly. I had a little bit of fun kind of digging this up because I think we tend to think that things just kind of appear and sometimes we forget the history of how things evolved.
Right.
Really with technology, it's easy to pick up our phones and just look at it as like something that has come about since like the early 2000s or late 2000s. So dating apps actually have quite a history in matchmaking, in newspapers and personal ads, right, and all this kind of stuff.
I remember those classified ads.
Right. When at the end of the newspaper or something, there'd be the personal section, yeah, or the classified section, and you could find job ads, you could find want ads, and people could put in information about dating. You know, they could say, describe themselves and have somebody else respond to a phone call. Or sometimes you could put in missed connections, say you're looking for a person.
Oh, yeah. I saw you on the bus route and we had this moment.
Yeah.
Please contact me. I remember those.
Yeah. Yeah. And so dating apps were kind of came out like, with the advent of the internet and like online spaces, dating apps kind of evolved from online websites and chat rooms and forums where people were using them to connect. Mm-hmm. And so there were specific sites that were for different purposes, but there were certainly some around like dating and sexual interactions. And Craigslist might be one that comes to people's right. mind of the very based, like, I'm looking for this type of a thing. But yeah, so dating apps were popularized in the early 2010s. And are a result from the digitalization of dating services that really began in the 1990s. And interestingly, what many people might not realize about the history of dating apps is that apps, as we know them today, were actually first developed by and catered to queer men.
Okay.
So Grindr was the first one that really launched and became quite popular, and that was in 2009. Tinder wasn't launched until 2012, so 3 years later.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, in that regard, the history of dating apps is really a queer history because of how it catered to publics who were not able to share their identities in person. And so where queer people are concerned, it offered a safe space where they could connect with other people in non-visible ways.
Yeah, where there might be a risk, for example, of trying to make a connection in person.
Exactly.
This risk is mitigated, or at least that's the hope.
Right.
When you're trying to connect with people online.
And once again, that history is tied into what we see in the politics and societal issues that were coming out of the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, where gay okay really started to take hold, but was also embedded in concerns around like HIV AIDS, around like the feminist movements were happening at that time. There's a lot of things that contributed to this movement of how queer people were searching for spaces where they could be themselves and seek these interactions in truly safe ways, in terms of sexual health, but as well as physical health, right?
Right.
So this is part of the reason why I was really excited about this question is because I don't know that listeners or the general public is aware of the history of how dating apps evolves. And it comes from such a queer history around safety and health.
Yeah, I think you're right that quite often when a technology is like ready to hand, like a dating app that you can just load on your phone, you don't necessarily reflect about the history of it or why it exists or how it came to exist, that these technologies that are just kind of ready to hand. I mean, we know that's not true, particularly those of us who are older, and I'm an older millennial woman. We know that these dating apps were not always there, but we don't necessarily reflect on that. So I really appreciate you bringing that history forward for us.
My pleasure.
So how do they work for anybody who hasn't used them?
Yeah. So once again, I think this is such a great question because on one hand, it seems so basic, but on the other hand, there's such a difference in terms of how they work. So in terms of how they work, quite basically, dating apps function on this premise of geolocating services. So they match people based on geographic proximity. And so with the software of the app, they use your GPS to find people who are in a close radius and then present you as a match or somebody that you can contact. That's the bare bones of it. And in that sense, it's not necessarily very different than any other social media platforms that would like connect you with people nearby.
Right.
But this one comes with the premise of, or in some senses, the promise of, we're going to give you a pool of people that you can access online that allows you then to meet in person. And once again, that premise is very similar to what we've seen over the personal ads and like online dating websites prior to apps, is that we're going to give you a pool that you can access that allows you to have the relationship in person that you desire. Granted, with apps and technology, not everybody is looking for an in-person interaction. Many people are very, very happy for it to stay in the digital space. That's fine. But in terms of how they work, getting back to your question, there are so many different softwares that are embedded in these apps that although we categorize them as dating apps, they actually function very differently in terms of logistics. So like Tinder being one of the most popular ones, or Bumble, some of these, they tend to use like a swipe logic, right? Where you find your match.
Right.
If you swipe left, you're not interested. If you swipe right, you are interested. And if you both swipe right, then you can start chatting. Not all dating apps function that way. So for instance, Grindr, Scruff, Hornet, and others have a grid. So when people log in, they automatically have access to everybody in their geographic location.
Oh, okay.
It just shows, for instance, on Grindr, I think the first 200 people that are close. And then if you use filters, you can filter based on age or ethnicity, which we can talk about in a bit.
Yeah, we definitely will.
But those filters then allow you to narrow your search so that you still see like 200 people in your grid, but based on the criteria that you're looking for. And that one you don't match. You literally just go to click on somebody's little image and you can automatically start talking to them.
So you send them a message and see what happens.
Exactly.
As opposed to hoping that we both swipe right.
Right. And even with that swiping right, there's variations. So like Coffee Meets Bagel and Bumble both put time limits. So once you first match, you have 24 hours to start a chat. And if not, that match disappears. And this, of course, brings out like conversations around like being on apps. And since these are free apps, you know, marketing, publicity, like consuming apps. So, you know, there's certainly that logic that comes in from the company side.
It feels like there would be this pressure, like I need to stay on the app because what if I miss my match, right? Like what if I take a digital vacation for the weekend and I miss my match?
Very much so. And so this is where the premise can be very simple or similar, but the variations can have implications on how people think and interact in those spaces.
Right.
Happn is another one that matches people. But Happn is one that it really emphasizes the geographic location piece and only presents you with matches of people that you've crossed as you've gone through your day-to-day interactions. So like, for instance, if you're walking down Main Street and then turn left onto Hill Street and then right onto Maple, if you've crossed paths with somebody in the real world, if you will, then that match will show up.
I find that kind of really uncomfortable.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. I mean, again, we could have many more conversations around companies and datafication and all of these types of things. But that's the premise of Happn, is that you happen across people that you've crossed in your day-to-day life.
So it's sort of trying to manufacture a meet cute.
Yeah. I mean, they've marketed themselves as playing back to this idea of like a missed connection. You know, you might turn your head when you pass somebody on the street. So we're going to help make that easier for you. But what's also really interesting, and there's this app called Lex, which is targeted towards queer public specifically, but it actually has kept this text-based personals ad that we've seen in the 90s, pre-digital spaces. Lex actually has maintained that as their entire interface. So it functions exactly like newspaper personals did pre-internet. You get a certain number of characters, you post a message, and then you see a certain number of them, again, based on geographic proximity. But you get to connect with people not based on images or matches, but based on the text that you find appealing.
So not all of these are image-based, it sounds like.
Nope.
But a lot of them are.
Yes, yes. The majority of them are that way. Lex is one of the few that has really emphasized the text-based interaction.
So when we think about them as image-based, perhaps we can bring back in this idea of intersectionality. Mm-hmm. So we have some of the initial intention behind a lot of these dating sites and then dating apps was to create this safe space for men who have sex with men, or MSM, to meet and connect. But now that we're bringing intersectionality in and recognizing that many of these apps are image-based, not text-based, what might we notice here? Or what did your research uncover?
Yeah. And so once again, I want to say that my research is not unique in this sense that, like, what I've put in this chapter is meant to be kind of a collection of what many people have experienced in their everyday lives.
Yeah.
So I don't try to claim this is original work in that sense. You know, it's not all things that I'm uncovering for the first time. It's more so a collection of these ideas so that people can understand that this, from a like empirical sense, this is a problem that needs to be addressed.
Many people, I would imagine, are already pretty aware of this problem. Right?
Exactly.
Like many of your participants are well aware of this problem, but it's good to have it kind of laid out in this empirical format for people who maybe aren't aware, or for even people who are aware, to have it legitimized again and say, it's not just me, there's all these people who are experiencing this.
Exactly. And in that regard, I feel that research and education are so important because it gives people the words and the validity to make sense of their experiences. So yeah, to answer your question, you know, when we think of intersectionality in these dating apps, just because there is this community of MSM, men who have sex with men, or, you know, the LGBTQ+ community, that doesn't mean that everybody has the same experience. Mm-hmm. And certainly when we take the intersectional approach, it very vividly demonstrates that that is not the case. People have different sorts of interactions. They feel varying levels of safety. This can impact their mental health, their sexual health in very different ways because of how people interact. And in this case, as I talk about in this chapter, how racism comes into play to impact people's experiences on dating apps or through dating apps. So one example of this, particularly to emphasize the intersectional aspect, because again, intersectionality is not just about one identity, it's about numerous identities, is on these queer gay dating apps, the phrase no fats, no femmes, no Asians.
Ooh.
Yeah. This hasn't been as, I think it's kind of gone out of style, thankfully. This was much more prevalent years ago. But nonetheless, it's one that has certainly been embedded in queer culture that people are familiar with. So at its height, for instance, there was Kim Chi, who's a famous drag performer who was on RuPaul's Drag Race. She actually did a spoof of this phrase, no fats, no femmes, no Asians, in her finale of her season. So what she did is her song was titled Fat Femme Asian, and it was meant to reclaim these identities in an empowering way rather than like being a victim of that discrimination and racism. I think it's really important to note that with this example of no fats, no femmes, no Asians, we're seeing the racism here in terms of no Asians, but we're also seeing discrimination based on body type, so no fats. Mm-hmm. We're seeing discrimination based on gender expression, gender identity, no femmes. And so by taking this intersectional approach, and certainly with this well-known phrase, no fats, no femmes, no Asian, it really reminds us how identities intersect and how people with different identities will have very, very different experiences. And the phrase no fats, no femmes, no Asians was one that people would put on their profiles to signify that they were not interested in any one of these categories or in more than one of these categories.
Right. So it was put in profiles. I think you also say in your research that even if it wasn't in the profile, people would sometimes send that as a message back. So if we think about, for example, Grindr, where it's not about swiping to get a match, but you send a message like, hey, how's it going? Or hello, or something, that people would receive this in reply based, again, solely on a discrimination regarding their image or the way their image was presented on the app.
For sure. And not everybody is going to be so explicit by saying no this, no that, no whatever. While some people might say no fats, no femmes, no Asians, other people will be more covert or indirect in order to hide their racism. And so what some of my participants said is that folks would respond to them and say, oh, you're cute, but you're not my type.
Right.
And yeah. And so that's an example of what Butler calls a speech act.
This is Judith Butler, right?
Judith Butler, yes. Yeah. And so this is, it's a phrase that can be well understood in terms of its meaning, but it's meant to obfuscate the actual meaning and confuse it so that if, for instance, somebody who receives the response, you're not my type, you know, and calls it out, then the original, the sender of that phrase can say, no, it's not about racism. It's just who I'm attracted to.
It's just my sexual preference.
Exactly. And right. So it's specifically done in that particular way in order to hide the racism and in order to hide the discrimination.
So this gets us to a couple of different forms of racism that you identified in your research that are quite common. Again, probably many users of the app are already aware of this, though they may not have necessarily the language to name it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the two forms that you identified that are quite common are sexual racism and the other form is racial fetishization. Can you elaborate, and I think we've already kind of touched on this, but can you elaborate a bit on what sexual racism is or how it operates?
Yeah, so sexual racism is quite simply when people exclude potential sexual partners based on race. So it's racism, but in the context of sex and sexuality, intimacy, romance. And so in this sense, it's not necessarily any different than any other type of racism or just racism in general. It's just that it specifically manifests in these intimate or sexual interactions.
And we can also loop back in to return to your discussion of speech acts with the idea of saying, you're not my type, as a way of concealing the sexual racism. Would that be fair?
100%. Completely. And yeah, as I was saying a minute ago, that's exactly the point, is because when you use words like type, that can be, it's both so personal, but it's also so vague. You know, there could be so many reasons why you're not into somebody. And so it could be directed at racism, but, or like directed at race, but it might not. Right.
Right. So it might be like, we don't have the same political views.
Right. I'm not interested at this point. You know, you're too young, you're too old, you're too this, you're too that.
You're looking for a certain kind of relationship that I'm not looking for.
Yeah. And based on any type of cue that's on the person's profile, you know, and it might not even be about the person themselves. It could be about the person who's saying it, you know, their own individual thoughts or how they project that onto another person. It's just that in this way, speech acts can be so powerful because the meaning can be so well understood, and yet it is by no means clear, which then allows, as you said before, it to be concealed. And
right.
It gives the person the ability to not be held accountable for their discrimination.
Right. So it's kind of a plausible deniability, or not terribly plausible deniability.
Yeah, but very much so. It's intended to be that, 100%.
Okay. So what about the other quite common type of racism you found, this racial fetishization? Can you talk about what that is, and perhaps also how people may try to normalize that?
Yeah. So while people can be excluded, like sexually excluded because of their race, sexual racism, people can also be specifically sought after because of their race. And so this is done through racial stereotyping, or specifically like racial fetishization. And so in these instances, race becomes an object of sexual desire rather than a criteria through which one is excluded. So race then exists for the pleasure of the other person rather than an identity that a person holds. So the fetishization of racialized bodies allows race to be more easily consumed by MSM, specifically white MSM. So in this way, MSM can experiment with racialized bodies that are comfortable or temporary, accessible, you know, on their terms. It turns it, as I said before, into an object of desire, which means that the probably white MSM is allowed to take advantage of and exploit the identity of race for their own sexual pleasure.
Right.
So just along those lines, what this means is when race is fetishized, it dehumanizes the person and it reduces them to a sexual object that exists for the pleasure of the other person. So identity, you know, this entire person becomes an object.
So when we're thinking about racial fetishization, and quite often, as you say, we're talking about white MSM engaging in racial fetishization, to what degree do fantasies kind of play a role here in terms of objectifying the bodies or the races of these people that white MSM are messaging and trying to engage with?
Yeah, so the one that immediately comes to mind is the BBC, or the Big Black Cock. And this is a category not only that you might see on apps, but this is prominent in pornography as well. There's, if you go to like Pornhub or other sites, the mainstream is assumed to be white. And then anytime you veer from the mainstream, from away from the normative white identity, then you become a category. Something is that is non-normative. So Big Black Cocks is the fetishization. Again, racial stereotype of hyper-masculine black men, where the black man is seen as having this big black cock. He and his body become an object of desire for someone else.
Right. And one thing I think is really interesting in that answer that I kind of want to tease out is that what we're seeing then on these dating apps, and I think we know this, but I want to tease it out anyway. What we're seeing on these dating apps is not exclusive to the apps, right? They exist in this culture and are supported by discriminatory and racist sexual scripts that exist, as you said, in pornography, but not only in pornography, kind of in society more generally.
Very much so. Yeah. And this is where apps, the online world, internet, none of this is necessarily different from what exists. And so this is, you know, as technology becomes more and more embedded in our day-to-day lives, we have to understand that the digital world is not separate from the physical world, right? It's still a medium through which we interact, just like you could go to a bar or a library or something. It's a means of connecting with people. And so these are still people who are interacting via digital technologies. So the racism is still there. The discrimination is still there. All of this exists, and it's not unique to dating apps. It's not unique to the internet. It just means that it's
just reproduced on the dating apps.
And quite honestly, with online interactions and in spaces like dating apps, or, you know, if you go to the YouTube comments, for example, when people, I bring that up as an example, because you immediately have this idea of how people have been liberated in online spaces to say whatever the heck they want, or to do whatever the heck they want to do. And that kind, that anonymity, that the ability to be invisible, to be protected online, protected not in terms of the person who's targeted, but protected in terms of the perpetrator, you know, you can say and do whatever you want in many ways without consequence.
Right.
And so bringing that back to the context of dating apps, it just, the anonymity and the invisibility of being in these online spaces, and with examples like Grindr, where you don't have to have a profile photo, where you don't have to put in information, unlike Tinder, where it matched, where it links up to your Facebook account, for example, you can be as invisible as you want on these platforms, which means you can say or do anything without people knowing that it's you. So in that sense, the digital space allows people to be more discriminatory, to be more racist, to be all of these things exaggerated, because there's no types of social boundaries that might limit those inhibitions.
Right. So what we're seeing then is a reproduction and perhaps amplification of discrimination in these digital spaces.
Yeah.
Because people who already have power in the non-digital world continue to take that power and that privilege into these digital spaces, and it's amplified by the perceived safety of anonymity.
Yeah. And it's anonymity is one. There's numerous affordances. You know, now we're getting into like science and technology studies, like comms and media studies, you know, and this is where my research sits at a very fun intersection of these different domains. But yeah, completely. The affordances of online spaces really amplifies, it doesn't have to, but it amplifies these discriminations for sure. I do want to say one more thing about racial fetishization, specifically as it relates to the example that I gave around the BBC. I specifically want to emphasize that when people fetishize bodies, what it really does is it not only objectifies the person, but it completely removes any type of historical or political meanings that are embedded in people's identities. So again, if we're looking at Black people as an example, this completely ignores hundreds of years, you know, centuries of violence and racism. And so it completely removes the context of identity, the political, the historical, the violent histories that have existed, again, in the relationship, not with the identity of the person themselves, but the relationship between a white man and a Black man, for example, here, that relationship, that history of violence. And so when we're thinking about white MSM who interact with racialized or Black MSM in this specific example, these fetishizations actually are informed by white men's construction of Black men as animalistic and savage. This idea that Black men could only be tamed under white men's discipline and control, who they could then domesticate through slavery and through violence. So once again, racial fetishization erases all of these histories, and not only objectifies, but ignores really important aspects of a person's identity.
Yeah, I think that's a really important thing to highlight. And these sexual scripts that we see reproduced online, reproduced in pornography, reproduced in mainstream media, they didn't occur in a vacuum.
Right.
We have a history of white people constructing racist scripts and applying them to the bodies of people of color, different scripts for different people. And as you've said, there is this sexual script that has existed for a long time placed on the bodies of Black men.
Mm-hmm. This is one of the many reasons that I find it so important to do this work is, as a white person, I have a responsibility. I'm part of these communities. I can't say that I will ever fully understand what a racialized person, what a person of color is going through, but I have a responsibility by being part of a society to do better. This is why I want to have these types of conversations, and I want to challenge my students and other people to think about these types of things, is because whether or not it impacts us directly, we share a society that expects some things from one another. And a very obvious example right now is, of course, with COVID. You know, even if you yourself decide not to take the vaccine, that has implications on everybody around you. So I think that race and racism is just a whole, it's the same type of idea that even if you choose not to engage with this, or if you decide to be not racist versus anti-racist, you know, there are implications to all of our actions that have consequences on other people.
And a lot of what we're seeing here is that the social context and the social consequence is often downplayed, ignored, or erased, right? So if I say, you're just not my type, hey, that's just about me, right? Like, it's not about wider contexts of racism. Or if I say, oh, I have this fantasy and I would like this person to be a part of it, again, I'm trying to say that that's about my own sexuality and my own sexual desire. And I'm not considering the context in which this fantasy was born,
right?
For example.
Or how it impacts another person who's a human being with emotions and feelings and their own wants and desires and needs and boundaries, etc.
So I want to talk about the platforms themselves for a moment.
Sure.
We noted earlier and said we were going to come back to it, that Grindr, for example, has in the past offered users an ethnicity filter that allowed a user to filter the app such that the only potential matches they would see would be of a specific ethnicity.
Right.
I believe this is a filter people had to pay for, so it wasn't part of the original free package that you get when you download the app.
Yep.
So can you speak a little bit about this filter?
Yeah. So Grindr, like many apps, has a free version and a paid version. And so prior to June 2020, and Grindr wasn't the only one. Scruff is another app. There's been other apps who have had a version of this. But prior to June 2020, Grindr and Scruff both had an ethnicity filter that allowed people to sort and view MSM based on their race and ethnicity. And so it was a paid filter, which we can talk about in a moment. But with the ethnicity filter, MSM could cleanse dating sites of racialized bodies so that they wouldn't ever see a non-white body online, or that they could only see a particular type of body. And so, you know, if you're excluding people of a particular race or just racialized people as an entire category, then, you know, this can be referred to as whitewashing, which is the social exclusion of racialized MSM from gay culture.
Okay. So other dating apps already had this. Grindr is not exclusive here. And it exists on these mediums because this kind of racism exists in society as well.
Completely. You know, and this is one thing that Pride celebrations have been criticized for numerous years, is that it tends to be a very like white, cis-oriented and gay versus queer space. You know, like we can tease these types of identities out. And not just Pride celebrations, but also companies. And we see this not only with whitewashing, where we're privileging white bodies, but also pinkwashing, where some businesses might be appealing to LGBTQ plus communities only for a specific month of the year, etc. So again, once again, the things that we're seeing online are not unique to online spaces. It's just that they have certain implications in those online spaces.
Right.
Going back to the ethnicity filter, this was a practice that participants in my study shared, but had been well known for numerous years, is that the ethnicity filter really allowed users to remove racialized MSM from the app. And it wasn't just the filter that allowed people to do so. There's other ways to do it, such as like blocking people. So blocking, it was an affordance that's intended to stop harassing or violent people from interacting with you. But who's to say that you can't use this affordance for something else? So once again, people might be blocking somebody based on their race, which would remove them from their app entirely.
Right. I think it's interesting, problematic, lots to dig into, that the ethnicity filter was something you had to purchase.
Oh yeah, let's get back to that. I do want to talk about that. Right. And so this is once again how online spaces can be very, I like how you said it before, it can amplify what we see happening in society. And so these apps were able to capitalize on racism by putting it behind a paywall. which meant that if you wanted to act in a racist way but not be visibly racist, what you could do then is access the ethnicity filter and look for exactly who you wanted to.
And other people wouldn't know that you had activated the filter,
right? Exactly, right. And that's exactly what I was just going to say, is that it doesn't demonstrate this to other people. It only shows up on your interface and not in terms of how other people interact with the app.
Right. So it even removes the need for you to perform a speech act.
Right.
You don't have to tell someone you're not my type.
So yeah, and this is the interesting part with filters, is it doesn't remove people like blocking would. The filter just, it allows you to see certain people. So somebody else who's outside of your filter could still contact you.
Oh, okay.
So you might still engage in those speech acts. Those people might not be visible. Those who you don't want to see might not be visible. But it did allow for these apps to truly monetize the fact that they knew people would categorize and look for others based on certain criteria. And age, I think if we want to talk about discrimination, that's a whole nother one that we could have long conversations about. When we have age-based discrimination, it tends to be much more socially acceptable in society. And so the age-based filter has continued to be free, but then the ethnicity filter was paid. It was a paid filter which commodified the dating app experience so that users' social relations, how they interact with the app, might encourage people to think about each other as objects that can be consumed and thrown away based on race or ethnicity.
Wow. So the filter has now been removed.
Yes.
What are your participants' thoughts about the removal of the filter?
Yeah, so the filter was removed in June of 2020. The removal of the filter was a direct consequence of the Black Lives Matter protests that were happening during that time. And so the BLM protests successfully pressured Grindr and Scruff to remove the ethnicity filter. And to answer your question, some people might think of the removal of the filter as a good thing, because now it doesn't allow people to filter based on race. But what's also really interesting to think about is that so far in our conversation, we have had a white-centric conversation around this ethnicity filter, or not necessarily white-centric, but centric around white supremacy. So people who subscribe to white supremacy, which are typically white people, we would filter based on race. However, what's interesting to know, and what many people said once the filter was removed in June, July of 2020, was that the ethnicity filter could actually be used for good.
Okay.
And so we recenter ourselves around the experiences of racialized people. What then the ethnicity filter allowed for was for folks to find other people like them. So this could create, in some senses, a safer space so that people of color could only see, and if they wanted to, only interact with other people of color.
Mm-hmm.
So it turned a space that could be potentially violent or harmful, or, you know, if they crossed a profile that said no fats, no femmes, no Asians, it helped them remove that visibility from their app experience. Again, it doesn't say it doesn't exist, but it filtered it in a way that would then allow the app to feel safer, to be more comfortable for those who are using it.
So you could limit the amount of exposure you have to sexual racism and potentially racial fetishization by limiting your exposure to the profiles of people who may be posting these kind of harmful things on their profiles.
Yeah. And so once again, as is the case with all technology, with any type of affordance, there's going to be goods, there's going to be bads. And that's quite a simplistic way to answer this type of a question. But I think it's important to recognize that technology and apps, you know, these are tools that allow people to interact in certain ways. And sometimes there's intended uses, you know, in terms of blocking. It's intended to protect from people who could be harassing. But then there's also developed uses in terms of like blocking people based on race or ethnicity. So once again, the ethnicity filter is a good example of this because it's a tool that allows people to do with it what they would like. So it can be good, be used for good, it can be used for harm. But what I want to emphasize is that the removal of the ethnicity filter didn't remove racism. And once again, this comes back to a conversation, you know, a theme that we've really reiterated numerous times, which I'm happy about. It's just that we have to remind ourselves, as I've explained in my findings, and as many other people's experiences have demonstrated, racism manifests in numerous ways. You know, deleting the filter won't stop people from being racist.
So I want to return to something you brought up earlier when we were talking about how different apps function and how different apps engage the user. And we talked, for example, about the match system that some of these apps employ and how you only have like 24 hours to respond versus the way other things might work. Because I think one thing that you note in your research is that the user interface of these dating apps might actually be affecting the way users engage.
Mm-hmm.
So you have an interviewee, there are pseudonyms for all the interviewees. So the pseudonym is Lewis.
Yep.
And this is quoting from your chapter. Lewis said, "So we're fantasizing because we have a menu. We don't like somebody, next. We don't like him, block him, even better." And I found this response, as well as some of the other things that you discovered about users' use of these apps, really interesting, because I have heard dating apps being compared to a menu, users describing it as casually browsing. And so I wondered if you could elaborate on some of the different user interfaces a bit more here and how they might affect user experience.
Yeah. And I'm really happy that you brought up this quote, because as anybody who's writing a paper or an article or a chapter can relate to, you have to be very careful about, you know, word count and all these types of things. So Lewis wasn't actually the only participant who talked about apps as a menu. And just because of space, I had to, you know, I chose the most interesting quote and his made the cut. But there's another one that I want to share with you now that was actually from another participant, Diego, who specifically also used the word menu. And here again, I'm going to be reading word for word what Diego said.
Awesome.
He said, "I know it's a bit of a ridiculous thing, but the way I see it is really like you are in front of a shop or in front of a restaurant. You look at a menu, you browse, then, oh, I have a craving for this. Today I want fries. Tomorrow I want ice cream. And the next day I want the biggest hamburger. Just to simplify things, what I look for first in this app is to satisfy my immediate need. Because I'm horny, I want to get laid. That would be my immediate need."
Okay.
I really appreciate how he, the metaphor that he used, not to go beyond a menu and specifically even use foods.
Yeah.
And even the, you know, the implications are like the pictures that get conjured in your mind when even he says like, "And the next day I want the biggest hamburger." You know? Like, I love the visual imagery of this. But I think it's so fascinating because it's, and it particularly relates to this point, your point about the interfaces, because with Grindr specifically, because of how it's designed, where you have all of these different squares in front of you, you know, you're truly looking at a grid of people's faces or just of profiles, right? Not everybody has an image up. But so you get to tap on somebody and see if the information that you're receiving satisfies your craving, if it will satisfy your desire.
Right.
And so in that sense, it is kind of like a menu. You truly have your choice of who you want to interact with. And based on what your taste is in that moment, you could pursue somebody or not.
I also think it's kind of interesting that both these quotes, and particularly that second one you gave from Diego, center the user's desires and the user's needs,
mm-hmm.
rather than perhaps centering, I don't know, a connection or reciprocity or a relationship or something like that. Is that a part of the interface of these apps as well?
Very much so. And I think it's emphasized further in apps that are catering towards men who have sex with men, because if once again, identity comes into play, is that with a history of gay or queer men's identities, so often sexuality is emphasizing the immediacy of a sexual interaction that, and this goes to a stereotype around gay queer men, is that men are always looking for sex, are always seeking sex, are always open to sex. And this has implications on consent as well, in terms of being perceived as always consenting to sex.
Right.
Which then mitigates the violence that somebody could experience, because if their consent is implied, then they won't be experiencing violence. Anyway, again, that's a whole other conversation. But to answer your point directly, yes, I think it certainly comes back to identity here. And in the case of gay men's experiences, how we're looking to feed a particular desire as quickly and as specific to the individual as possible. Like, I know what I want, and that's a sexual interaction in XYZ way. I want it to be in these terms at this time. Is this person hosting? Are they coming over? Are we using a condom? Are we not? You know, we can really prescribe, we can negotiate all of those different aspects in the apps. And once again, I don't want to say that this is necessarily a bad thing. In some senses, this can really, like the openness of apps can facilitate honest conversations about condom use, about people's STI status. It can facilitate and encourage people to have negotiations around the sexual encounter so that rather than just showing up and not being able to voice that, power people to talk about what they really want. Once again, however, it's not always in a good way because people might be empowered to act in racist or discriminatory ways, right?
Right.
So this is where it's, you know, there's so much nuance.
It's complicated.
Yeah, it's complicated.
Yeah, you've brought up this issue of consent, and this is something you also raise in the chapter. You note that the racism and other forms of discrimination that exist on dating apps and in the world create a bit of a perceived power hierarchy, and that this can lead to marginalized men to agree to certain sexual acts or sexual encounters that they might otherwise refuse to be a part of. So I wonder if you can talk about these issues and consent a bit more.
I find this idea of consent to be so fascinating because it permeates so many aspects of our lives and how people experience violence as well as enjoyment. You know, like consent can facilitate in a positive way or a negative way the experiences that we have. And once again, it's not unique to a sexual interaction. We're seeing this play out right now, particularly around vaccines and COVID, et cetera.
Yeah.
You know, where the conversations people are having around what they expect of themselves and what they expect of others are truly conversations around consent and boundaries, what we feel comfortable doing, what we don't feel comfortable doing, in what situation, with whom, et cetera. So to go back to your question around how, around the aspect of power and hierarchies and privilege and stuff, you know, this also relates to your question of intersectionality. And so what I want to actually do is start this off by once again reading a quote from one of the participants.
Perfect.
And I find this to be so illustrative of this point in particular that I want to use the participant's words to capture this completely. So this quote comes from Jaden, who's a Black male who was in my study. And he said, for example, the white privileged male, so blonde hair, blue eyes, they know they have an advantage over you because less people want to sleep with a Black male or less people want to sleep with an Asian guy. The white privileged male can message any number of people and get far more responses than the Asian guy who knows he's not going to get as many responses. He knows that in messaging the Asian guy, there's a power dynamic there where he is the one who has the advantage. And essentially, whatever he wants, whatever he says, whatever he does will fly more because, well, the person without the advantage kind of has to take whatever's biting at him. Like, lucky him, he's the one who's getting the attention, so he gives into it. And even if he recognizes it, he bites his tongue because, at the end of the day, he needs to get his rocks off too. And I think this is so powerful because it demonstrates this idea of power and how the quote that I have in mind is that everything is about sex except sex, which is about power.
Right.
It's this idea that within this sexual space, it is about power and people have their sexual desires and want their sexual desires to be fulfilled in an enjoyable and safe way. But at the same time, taking an intersectional approach, we have to understand how identity comes in. And so somebody who has more privilege in these spaces, intentionally or unintentionally, might use that power to take advantage of somebody else, to coerce somebody else, to manipulate someone else. And again, whether or not they are aware of it, somebody who's on the receiving end might be willing to accept that abuse of power because then they have access to somebody who has more social privilege than they do, or because they are able to access a body or a person that they might not otherwise have access to, right? So there's a lot of implications here, but this is certainly around the question of consent where consent can become so important, but then also have so many nuances to it that is somebody actually even consenting to this type of thing, or are they being abused or coerced, manipulated in some way?
Yeah. And I think questions of coercion and manipulation, whether intended or unintended, are really important to keep in mind, that just receiving a go-ahead or a yes doesn't necessarily allow us to dig into these layers of power, privilege, marginalization, and how that affects whether or not somebody feels that they need to say yes.
Mm-hmm. And once again, I'm going to turn to Jaden to give another quote that will illustrates this point. He continued and he said, in the past, if someone was interested in me, I was like, wow, you're interested in me. And that comes to self-esteem issues in regard to race and ending up in a situation like, well, this person is interested in me. And since they're interested in me, I'm going to go and do whatever it is that they want to do to me, even if I don't want to. In that sense, it's not really consent because it's highly influenced and manipulated.
Yeah. And I do think that the point about self-esteem, perceived feelings of self-worth, again, this goes back to the community issue, right? It's not just about individuals. Mm-hmm. We do rely on each other to bolster our self-worth, to bolster our self-esteem. And that also creates complications in power dynamics and power hierarchies, particularly for people who have been marginalized, who have not been recognized as having self-worth by dominant normative scripts.
Very much so. And once again, I would like to give one more quote.
okay.
Because I want to, again, emphasizing the intersectionality of all of this, I really want to recognize that this isn't just like an issue that Black MSM deal with. This is something that
yes.
racialized people, that people of marginalized identities or non-normative identities experience in many different ways. So once again, today we're focusing on race, but this could come about in terms of body type or gender expression, all many types of different things. But the other quote that I want to share, which is totally along these lines, comes from Aang, who identifies as an Asian male. And he said, "There's a very clearly defined hierarchy of power preference, at least in gay culture. There's a high preference for cisgender white men. And the lighter your skin color, or the more likely you are to pass as white, the more power you've got, and the more attractive you're seen, and the more that you can get away with. So if you do something that is non-consensual, you could get away with it."
That's, yeah. I mean, that pretty much sums it up.
Yeah. And this is truly where, you know, when we're talking about sexual racism, when we're talking about racial fetishization, you know, these truly are questions not only about race and identity, but also around consent and violence. What is one person doing to another person? And how have they abused, again, coming back to this idea of power, how are they abusing that power to take advantage or to commit harm to another person?
And as you've said, the apps can be used to amplify this. But we've also seen ways in which people might use the apps to mitigate this. So you talked about how we can have more open conversations about what I'm interested in or what I'm not interested in before anybody is in the room together. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't necessarily erase the power dynamic. It's still very much there, but it might help people feel safer expressing that they're not interested in something if they're not physically already in the space with somebody who has more power.
Right. If somebody comes across something like this, they can close the app, they can delete their account. You know, there's power as well that's embedded in the affordances of online technologies and digital apps. But it's, and I don't want to prioritize experience in terms of what is more violent or less violent, but when you get into a physical space with someone, there's potential for a different type of violence, physical violence,
yeah.
sexual violence that can be very, very harmful to a person. And so if you are able to filter someone out, if you are able to use those cues online to be able to protect yourself a bit more before even getting to that physical space, having these types of conversations could lead to having these open, honest conversations, these negotiations around consent and interests and pleasure, etc., can facilitate safer, more enjoyable sexual interactions in person. Not always, because, you know, it's not to say that what happens online is a promise for what will happen in person.
Or that the power dynamics aren't already there online.
Completely. You know, and once yeah. again, there's so much nuance here that, you know, maybe we could do another podcast to chat about other things. But this is where, once again, we have to understand that these technologies are tools that we can use for many, many different purposes, for good, for bad, right. for in between.
So is there anything else that you would like to leave our listeners with regarding dating apps, marginalization, racism today?
I would like to reiterate the point that I shared a bit ago, is that regardless of your identity, we are all humans that have responsibility to one another. And I think we should be held accountable to one another. And so we have to be aware of the communities and spaces that we occupy, and we must take action. Each of us is responsible for taking action to address discrimination, racism, and other forms of harm that exist online and in society in general. So what I would like to encourage listeners to do is learn more, ask these questions, especially for us as white people, so often we shy away from conversations around race because we're afraid of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing. And you know, I can relate to that. But just being afraid doesn't get the, you know, by being fearful of these types of things doesn't get the problem to go away. And so I really encourage my fellow white folks out there to be courageous, to pick up a book, to do the learning, to do the work, to understand what these issues are and what your responsibility is in these situations. Because we can't nor should we expect minority folks, like folks with racialized identities or other marginalized identities, to be doing all the work. We have to be there too. So that's what I would like to implore listeners to do, is to do the work and to have those hard conversations, work on that self-improvement, because we all have a lot that we can do.
This episode of Gender, Sex, and Tech continued a conversation begun in Chapter 5 of the book, Gender, Sex, and Tech, An Intersectional Feminist Guide. The chapter is called, I'm Not Your Fantasy, Sexual Racism, Racial Fetishization, and the Exploitation of Racialized Men Who Have Sex with Men. And it was written by Christopher Dietzel. I would like to thank Chris for joining me today for this important discussion. And I want to thank you, listener, for joining me for another episode of Gender, Sex, and Tech, Continuing the Conversation. If you'd like to continue this conversation further, please reach out on Twitter at @tech_gender, or you might consider creating your own essay, podcast, video, or other media format to continue the conversation in your own voice. Music for this episode provided by Epidemic Sound. This podcast is created by me, Jennifer Jill Fellows, with support from Douglas College in New Westminster, BC, and support from the Mark Sanders Foundation for Public Philosophy. Until next time, everyone. Bye.